So Gauss Kadatsi is a, well, or is, I guess, the name of formalism that I just want to describe today. So you've already seen some of the mechanics of it in the tutorial yesterday, but hopefully what I'll say today will maybe put it in a broader context and fit it into a framework. And the idea here is that we're dealing with submanifolds. In other words, subsets of our manifold, which are lower dimensional. So an example might be a plane in three dimensions. That would be an example of a submanifold. It's something lower dimensional. And given that I've been throughout the whole sort of past 2 weeks talking about general numbers of dimensions and then talking about solutions for Einstein gravity in, say, more than four dimensions or arbitrary numbers of dimensions, you can see this idea of possibly having a submanifold could also be related to the idea, the notion of extra dimensions. And it's used in, dynamical formulations of gravity in 3 plus, what's called 3 plus 1 formalism. The quantum gravity guys use this quite a lot, and certainly some of the, not just the notation, but some of the tools that we'll be seeing in the next hour. It's used if you want to look at physical objects which are effectively lower dimensional. So these domain walls, for example, they have a, they're a sort of sheet, very localized, of energy density. And so even though they have a finite thickness, if you're not really interested in the details of what they're made up of, from the large scale, they look like something that's lower dimensional. So again, this sort of formalism crops up when you're dealing with things that are effectively lower dimensional. And finally, it's also used to make sense of gravitational actions. So one of the things that you notice about the gravitational Einstein-Hilbert action is it's the integral of the Ricci scalar, and of course Einstein solutions have vanishing Ricci curvature. So all vacuum Einstein solutions have vanishing volume integral of r root g. And so normally you think of the action of a solution as somehow representing its likelihood or something to do with physical either likelihood or properties of the solution itself. And so if all of this, these huge, you know, an infinite family of solutions have vanishing action, how do we distinguish between them? And so the answer comes because when you integrate by parts to get the Einstein equations, we had boundary terms, and I flagged this at the time. And those boundary terms would not normally be set to zero in a standard Lagrangian variational process. And so again, this is where this geometry of submanifolds comes in. By looking at your boundary as having some dynamical properties, you can close off this little sort of wrinkle, if you like, in defining the gravitational action. So it makes it make sense. So it's known as Gauss-Kadatsi because those were the guys that developed it. But the idea is, pictorially, that we're going to have some subset in our manifold, sigma, which is a manifold in its own right. So sigma is contained in our space-time manifold. And it's a manifold in its own right. So that's the idea. So this is our picture. Our manifold's meant to be surrounding it. And that means if it's a manifold, we're going to have coordinates living on the manifold, some coordinate functions appropriate to the dimensionality of sigma. So I'm going to say sigma has dimension d. We're going to say that, say, M has dimension capital D. And so what that means is that there are N dimensions that do not lie in sigma. So we say this is the co-dimension of sigma. So what does that mean? Well, if this was sigma lying in our manifold, we would be able to define a normal to sigma. And what it means is that we can pick n normals to sigma. So n So the idea is that you can either, I think for our perspective, this is probably the better way to think about it. A normal means that it's going to annihilate all these coordinate functions on sigma. So this is what we kind of intuitively mean by a normal. And so we're also representing our surface as a set of functions. If we were looking at it from the perspective of our higher dimensional manifold, we would say, where is our surface sigma? Well, it's located at the coordinates x mu, and if it's more than zero dimensional in general, it's going to spread out across some surface defined by the functions x mu of sigma. And so taking the derivative x mu of sigma by d sigma gives you a parallel. So the notion is this is some parallel vector to sigma, and this is a normal vector to sigma. So in that second instance, we've used the metric. So I'm going to take the normals are going to be ni, where I runs from 1 to n, and I'm going to take ni mu nj mu equals delta plus or minus delta ij, depending on whether n is time-like or space-like. So that's the sort of setup. And then the idea is going to be that we, at this same point P on sigma, we know we've got a tangent space. We have a tangent space to the full manifold M. We've also got a tangent space to the manifold sigma. So that's two different tangent spaces. But we have this notion that we can split the tangent space in M into the piece that's sort of equivalent to the tangent space of sigma and the piece normal. So what we're going to do is we're simply going to break down the connection and curvature into sort of parallel and orthogonal components and sort of see what we get. So that's the basic idea of this formalism. So the first fundamental form, this is really talking about the metric and distance functions. The first fundamental form of sigma is essentially the projection of the metric parallel to sigma. And so what we're using here is the fact that the ends are talking about normal directions, so we need to subtract them off. And then I've said that I've taken them to have unit length, so that's why it's just plus or minus nn. And then the sign, because this is the real difference that if you read it in a pure maths book, the sign is taking account of the fact that we're in a Lorentzian signature, so we have space-like or time-like vectors. So if we had a completely space-like surface and a time-like normal, then we would want to get rid of GTT, and so GTT is plus one, so we need to subtract off NT, NT. Okay, so NT would just have, our normal would just be one and then a string of zeros, in some sense, right? So that's the reason for those signs there. So you can see that we're really just taking our full metric and then we're throwing away everything that's normal to sigma. So this first fundamental form H lies in the tangent space, or the tensor tangent space, cotangent space, of P, of M at P. So H is a tensor in the manifold rather than the submanifold. And so it's because it's something that's associated with the underlying manifold, you can think of it as being the distance that sigma inherits as, you know, out from being a submanifold of M. So that's a sort of higher dimensional perspective. However, if you lived on the submanifold sigma, you know that it's a manifold in its own right, so you would have your own intrinsic metric. And so you want to have this notion of an intrinsic metric. Let's see how we get that. Well, sigma A, as I said, are coordinates on sigma, on the manifold, sigma. So dx mu by d sigma A projects from the cotangent space of the manifold onto the cotangent space of sigma. So here I'm kind of, over here I sort of have this notion of M as being enveloping. This is sort of trying to go one step back and thinking of sigma as the manifold on its own. And then this map, XU, as an embedding of sigma into our higher dimensional manifold. So our intrinsic metric simply going to be take this space-time metric and project it down. So this actually equals H. So that's so far not, you know, I haven't really apparently done very much. All I've said is, you know, you can split your metric into orthogonal and a parallel part. So at the moment I'm not really worried too much about the orthogonal part, but the orthogonal part is carried or encoded in that family of normals. Yeah?
So a question in the early part. So would you mind explaining what that time-like and space-like means?
Well, it's just time-like and space-like.
So is this time-like and space-like used to like label the different directions of the normal?
Well, it's just whether or not the normal is time-like or space-like.
Okay,
so if the normal is time-like, you'd have to subtract it. If the normal is space-like, then you'd have to add that piece. So a time-like normal would occur if you had 3 plus 1 formalism. So there you would be taking a foliation of your space-time manifold by space-like surfaces, right? So you'd have a sort of a whole stack of space-like surfaces and a time-like normal running through them. So that would be an example of a time-like situation. A space-like normal would be pretty much every other situation that you meet this formalism in, which is if you had something that was a, you know, some physical object that was localized, so it had some sort of codimension, like the domain wall, like the cosmic strings, like the, you know, the sort of general brains, then the object that you're considering already has a time coordinate, so all its normals are going to be space-like. So that's a sort of example of each of those situations. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, what's the difference between the first time manifold and the intrinsic metric?
So, well, they're carrying the same information. The difference is that the intrinsic metric is an element of, so here, this thing, so this is intrinsic. So this thing is an element of the cotangent space of sigma squared rather than the cotangent space of the manifold. So they're in different spaces. Physically, no difference, carrying the same information. But you may want to have a setup where you regard your submanifold or your lower dimensional object as being manifold in its own right, where it has its own metric, and not necessarily, you know, you may only want to impose that intrinsic metric is the same as the inherited metric as part of a set of equations of motion. So you could imagine that setup, okay? So that's doing nothing so far. Believe it or not. So then, that's the first fundamental form. So the second fundamental form is to do with looking at connections. But it also has a more intuitive name, which is extrinsic curvature. And this is going to tell us something now. It's about the geometry of the embedding of the submanifold in M. So it's defined via a covariant derivative of the normal. So if I sketch my sigma here, I'm imagining a one-dimensional submanifold of the two-dimensional blackboard. So my normal field would be this. And so if, in this case, if this is my normal, so here I've just done something very sort of simple. I've got two-dimensional flat space, the blackboard, and I'm drawing a curve in it. I draw the normal to the curve, so that, and then I look at the derivative of the normal. So in this case, everything's flat, so you can see what's happening. And the derivative, you can see, is non-vanishing, because the surface is curving around. So if I look at how n is changing, you can see that there is a little shift. The rate of change of n as I move along is parallel to sigma. So n is changing because sigma is curved. So we can also write an intrinsic expression by simply projecting down, and then I could rewrite that in this form. So it's need to say what So the idea is to take a covariant derivative in the manifold, in the submanifold, you take the covariant derivative in the full manifold and then project it down. So it's the connection that sigma inherits from the full manifold. So it's taking, if you like, the connection of the full manifold and pushing it down onto sigma itself. So here, although this blackboard is flat, if I put in a curved line, sigma, then you could think of this as saying I want to split a connection, so it's just a flat connection, into something parallel and something perpendicular to sigma. But if I curve sigma, this is now setting a new family of coordinates. I've got a coordinate running along my submanifold, and then I've got, say, another coordinate normal to it. And as you know, even flat space, if you put it in a curvilinear coordinate system, which this clearly is, you pick up non-zero connection components. And so this is what that is doing. The K is telling you, if K is non-zero in this flat context, it's telling you you've got a curved embedding. And what does a curved embedding mean? It means that this thing is going, you know, sort of winding, curving around in the ambient manifold. And extrinsic curvature, why that is a more intuitive name for it, is it's saying that this surface looks curved. And so extrinsic means it's curving not within itself, but in terms of the outside, the ambient manifold. And it is, in many ways, extrinsic curvature is often our intuitive notion of curvature. And it's the reason why when we first meet the notion that a cylinder is flat, it's sort of, if you try telling someone who's never done any geometry or any maths on the street, say, this is a flat manifold, this is an example of a two-dimensional manifold and it's flat, they'll kind of, no way, you know, this is why, this is the sort of reaction. And the reason is that, yeah, this cylinder's flat, but as an embedding in R cubed, it has non-zero extrinsic curvature. And so it's the extrinsic curvature that we are sort of thinking of as being real curvature. So let's see that example. So I've got flat R cubed, so I'm not doing any funny manifold. My manifold is completely flat. And I'm taking a cylinder of radius A. So it's a cylinder in the XY direction and standing up in the Z direction. So it's got radius A. And my normal is obviously going to be pointing radially outwards in the XY plane. If I write it down in Cartesians, that's my normal. So it's got, I put it to have length 1, which is what I advertised. And if I write my first fundamental form, you can see that it doesn't exactly look, at least, you know, if you just blur your eyes and don't look at it too carefully, it doesn't sort of look like it's a projection operator, at least until you look at the trigonometric details. And the reason is that I've chosen to write it there in Cartesians. And so Cartesians are not necessarily a sort of natural set of coordinates adapted to this cylinder. But if I write it in polars, then it's more obvious. So there it's absolutely manifestly a projection operator. So now let's look at the extrinsic curvature. In this case, we're sort of, I just want to talk about it. I'm going to do it in a simpler context. So the extrinsic curvature is like the parallel components of the covariant derivative of n. So here we've got two choices. We can either compute things in Cartesians where the connection vanishes, but then we see that our n is distinct, you know, is not trivial. We have to worry about taking derivatives. And then we'll have to project down using this form of HAB. So we can do that. But given that the expression for H in polars is so much easier, and it's absolutely clear anyway that with a cylinder which is, you know, expressing, it's manifestly invariant under the U1 rotations, we're better off using polar coordinates to calculate our extrinsic curvature. So here, in our polar coordinates, so this is Cartesian, this would be polar, because it's just d by dr or dr. So in polar coordinates, my n is just 1, 0, 0, so I don't get any derivatives of n. And so the covariant derivative of n is just the connection components, which have an R index on the top. So this is just the flat connection in cylindrical polars. And so that is a fairly straightforward object. So just to interpret what that is, if I just slice off the R pieces, because that's the bit that wouldn't be there anyway, it would be projected out. What I've got here in terms of real extrinsic curvature components is I've simply got one in the theta slot. So here we've got theta z. So I've got theta z and theta and z. So I can think of theta and z really as being the coordinates on my cylinder. And this is saying that there's nothing going on in the z direction. So that's sort of translates nicely to our picture. Z is just sort of lines going up on the cylinder. But in the theta direction, I have a radius of curvature a. So it's telling me that in my theta direction, this cylinder has a radius of curvature. So that's what the k theta theta is telling me. So if I just keep that in mind, because so far I've just talked about extrinsic curvature, which is telling us something about how we're splitting the connection of our underlying manifold into parallel and perpendicular pieces. But I haven't said anything about what's happening to the normal part of the connection yet, so I should just deal with that. Many of the examples that you meet gaps Kadatsian are just codimension one. So really, in essence, everything usually can be projected down, or most of the structure can be projected down onto the underlying D minus one dimensional manifold. But if we have mention it, if we have a higher codimension, we can also have, again, non-trivial connection components even in a flat space. So the analogy here would be to take a curve, a one-dimensional submanifold of R cubed, and so a one-dimensional submanifold will have two normals. So if I just sketch what I'm going on about here, so I've got two normals, I could N1 and N2. So I could imagine simply, from the context, you know, using my flat connection on R cubed, just translating these around in parallel to themselves, more or less, except not if they're in curves. Or I could imagine just arbitrarily, I've got around this submanifold, I've now got a U1 symmetry, and so my normals could rotate around as I move along. And you can see that that's a gauge transformation because there's no meaning in it. I can sort of stand there, even with a straight line in the Z direction, I can stand there and spin. I can maybe go backwards and forwards as I move up the line, or I could twist my normals round. And that's going to give me some non-zero derivatives of the N, but not necessarily with physical contents. And so that's the equivalent of having curvilinear coordinates on a flat space. And so we have, that gives us a normal component of the connection. So I'm not going to go into this in too much depth, but I'm just going to note that, you know, you have to sort of think about the fact that both connection and curvature split into this parallel and normal part. And so here, this is saying, well, I've told you that I've taken my normals to be unit. I didn't explicitly say, but what you can also do is to extend them geodesically off your submanifold so that basically grad n of n is zero. But what this is doing is it's picking up the rate of change of n not along itself, but along the other normal. So if I sort of gratuitously twist my normals around as I move in my submanifold, I'm going to have a rate of change of N1 along N2, and so I'm picking up a non-zero beta. In this example, it would be pure gauge, but nonetheless, it's saying that what I'm kind of doing here is I'm taking coordinates sigma A along my submanifold, and then I'm giving a coordinate chart of M. So that's kind of physically what we're up to. We're saying that we've got a set of coordinates on the submanifold, and we're going to locally at least construct a local coordinate chart for our full manifold by taking the coordinates on the submanifold and then propagating them out along the normals. So sigma doesn't change as we move along a normal, but we have a coordinate for each normal, the size. And so if we choose, just like the curvilinear coordinates, or the having a curved submanifold is an analog of choosing curvilinear coordinates, there's also quite a large gauge freedom for the way we choose our normals in general. And that's what this would pick up. So now we want to think about curvature. So again, our curvature is just going to be d of connection plus connection squared. And so the Gauss equation So the Gauss equation relates curvature on our manifold, so this curvature, to the curvature on the submanifold and some extrinsic pieces. So notionally, you can see that if I want to think about what is my Riemann curvature of my submanifold, you can see that the first term on the left-hand side is saying, well, it picks up curvature if my underlying manifold is curved. So that's taking the Riemann curvature of my full manifold and just projecting it down onto the submanifold. But then, of course, if my manifold itself is curved as an embedding in sigma, that also means that maybe there's some sort of gauge parts in the gamma wedge gamma pieces, you know, when you define the curvature. I've got to make sure that I don't pick up any sort of unnecessary, or there's a piece that comes from this non-trivial embedding. So I'm going to show this for codimension one, just because that's a sort of sufficient to kind of illustrate it. And then talk a little bit about you know, what it means. So if I have codimension one, it means I'm not really having to worry about summing over the I. So I can simply have a single normal, single unit normal, and then my extrinsic curvature for a single unit normal, I'm going to really just sort of see that it's related with this covariant derivative. So let me see. I'm going to do this by using the Riemann identity, the fact that my Riemann tensor is defined as a commutator of covariant derivatives acting on a vector. And so I'm going to explore what I mean by right, so this is how I extract my d-dimensional, little d-dimensional, Riemann tensor. I do it by taking a commutator of derivatives acting on a vector. So, what does that tell me? So I defined my covariant derivative on the middle board there on the right by taking the higher dimensional covariant derivative and projecting every index down with the first fundamental form. So I've simply done that here for this first derivative, the grad C. And so I've now got to do it again for this part inside. This is the lower dimensional submanifold's covariant derivative. Okay, so again, I've simply replaced what it means to take the submanifold's covariant derivative of the vector v. So having written that down, I'm now just going to have to turn the handle and find out what the derivatives give me. So obviously, I'm going to get a piece that where this covariant derivative acts on the covariant derivative of v. So that's good, because that's you can see that that's going to, once I've worked out all the details, that's going to become the first term on the right-hand side of this Gauss identity. So pulling out this these two first fundamental forms, I'm getting HAQ, HFC, HPD, grad F, grad P of VQ. So that's my first term. And because I'm anti-symmetrizing on C and D, you can see that's going to induce an anti-symmetry on F and P, which induces the anti-symmetry here. Higher dimensional Riemann, and we've sorted with that term there. So we've got one of the pieces that we want, fairly straightforwardly. So next, what I've got to do is take derivatives of each of these H's in turn. So let me do that. I've got grad P VQ sitting outside. And then if I take a derivative of an H, remember that my H, the definition of my H is that it's G plus or minus NN. And so here, each of these H's is just G plus NN. So you can see that I'm going to pick up extrinsic curvature terms from these. So, let's see. And then, of course, I've got minus C interchanged with D. So let me just write it out in detail. So just writing that out in full, I'm just emphasizing that when I take the derivative of the first fundamental form, I'm going to pick up some components of extrinsic curvature. And so here, with both of these derivatives, I'm picking up a k times actually a normal. So if I have, for example, here, I've taken the first term, I've got in this term, I've got n with an index g, and if I look here, I've got a first fundamental form with an index g. So this is actually going to give me nothing. And for the second one, I've got n with an index p, and so this is simply hitting the normal derivative of v. So that's actually also going to give me nothing. For the second line, again, I'm writing this as delta plus nn. So when I've got the nenq here, if the and E comes outside, it'll hit this H, which will give me nothing. And so the only non-zero piece is when I get NQ times K FE. So I get I've turned the first term into my higher dimensional Riemann tensor. And then the second term So the second term, I said, simply picked up the single factor where the normal doesn't get immediately annihilated by any of the first fundamental forms. But then I can write this, because N and V are normal, I can simply reverse, sort of integrate by parts, if you like, and pull that N inside and pull the V outside. And so I simply get another component of the second fundamental form there. So this is I'm just relabeling my indices for the first part. And then the second part, I've now got VQ, K, PQ. So you can see that probably should have had minus to the I here. So you can see that if I change my Q there to a B, I've actually got the same result as I advertised there. So it's a bit of a sort of, you know, trek, keeping tabs, noticing that in fact almost everything just vanishes because of the orthogonality of normal with the first fundamental forms. But this is also showing you that if, I mean, all the examples that I've talked about, which are submanifolds sitting in three-dimensional space, there's more or less not enough degrees of freedom to construct anything too complicated. But it's also telling you that even if your higher dimensional manifold is flat, if you pick a particularly sufficiently contorted submanifold, then you will acquire a low dimensional curvature. And so the obvious example here is the two sphere as an embedding in flat R cubed. So I can embed the two sphere simply as the a surface which is a constant distance from the origin. And in this case, even though my higher dimensional manifold, R cubed, is flat, my two sphere is not. And so how would we see that? Well, we're going to see it because whereas the cylinder had just this single component of extrinsic curvature, it only curved in the theta direction, the two sphere is going to have a radius of curvature A in one angular direction and a radius of curvature A in the other angular direction. And so when you have, if you look at the combinations of the k squared terms, that's going to give you A squared. So you can see that your when you look at this particular combination here. So roughly speaking, you've got a radius of curvature A in each direction. So your k AB is going to be something like A times gamma AB. And so your Riemann curvature is going to look like A squared into delta AC . So that's essentially what you get. So this is a sort of standard example where you're constructing a genuine curve manifold as an embedding in a higher dimensional space. So much of our intuition of curve manifolds actually comes from sketching embeddings of surfaces in higher dimensional manifolds. So that's why when we first meet this fact about the cylinder, we're usually wrong-footed a little because our intuition about curvature comes from embeddings. But this is showing how in two examples, a cylinder, you can see for the cylinder, I've only got a single component of K. And so no matter what I do, either these k's are going to be zero or not, and if one of these is non-zero, the other one will be. So if you pop in that kAB, you'll see it gives a Riemann flat cylinder. Okay, so this afternoon at 2, we're having the next lecture, and then I want to show a couple of examples of this formalism. Where you meet it in two slightly different contexts. One's going to be where you meet it as a description of one of these lower dimensional brains. So we want to see how Gauss-Kadafsky might help give you some physics of lower dimensional submanifolds. And then I also want to show you how it regularizes the gravitational action, so how it sort of makes Einstein-Hilbert work by including dynamical boundaries.